Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 402. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always is James Jones.
Always.
John Linneman's having some computer problems, but we hope he will be joining us very shortly.
Always.
I'll introduce him. He's trying his best. I'll introduce him when he comes in. Guillaume is not able to record with us this week, but in his place we have a returning special guest, our good friend Mr. Craig Harris.
But not always. No.
But occasionally.
How's it going?
Welcome back, Craig.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's so good to hear from you, man.
Yeah, it's great. On my first day of unemployment, or fun employment, as it's called.
Yeah, I've been having some fun employment myself. Hopefully, we'll be ending soon. I actually had to trim out a couple of the games I've been playing just because I don't want the first segment to go on forever and ever. We have a lot of good games to talk about. We're getting into the meat of the holiday season. There's a bunch of stuff coming out. A lot of good things to discuss here on the show, and we're going to jump into it right off the bat with new business. And I figured James could go first, and we'll give Craig a minute to warm up here. But
yeah,
there's a little bit of overlap in what you guys have been playing.
We're going to lead off with a cell phone game. We talk about all the great new games coming out this year. Perfect.
Wait, let's talk about the demo. Come on.
Oh, the demo? Okay, if we're going to do the overlap, I thought we'd want to do the overlap later. Fine. Fine. Prima donna.
Speaking of prima donnas.
Yeah, well, there you go. Fine. So Nintendo released a Bayonetta 2 demo, seemingly in sync with the day the embargo went up on the reviews. I don't know if that was deliberate. I would assume it was. And it's pretty similar to the demo we played at E3. It might not be this. It's not the same stage. But
it is the same stage because you're on the F-16s or whatever they are flying around the city.
Isn't the boss fight different in that demo, though?
Maybe. I don't recall, but there's definitely the fighter plane thing.
There's definitely some overlap.
I think I played the fighter plane thing at last year's E3 even. And at this year's, I think they actually had multiple levels and I didn't play all of them.
Well, seeing the production values, I went into that demo. I'm guessing they reused, whatever assets they were working with, at E3 this year or last year. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was something you've already played. It costs a lot of money to make these demos and they put a lot of effort into this one demo that just goes on for a long time.
Yeah, it's a pretty meaty introduction to what Bayonetta is.
Oh, totally.
Which
feels like a complete mission, from early in the game. I think it is setting up the main thrust of the story.
Yeah, I would guess it's probably the first level of the game, or at least a big chunk of it.
I don't know if it's the first level. I mean, I have no idea because I haven't played the full game yet, but it just seems like it's like a vertical slice out of somewhere in the middle because I have no idea what's going on. Like, seriously, I have no, things are just happening.
Welcome to Bayonetta.
Things are just happening. You're on F-16s and you're flying around buildings and things are going on, but I don't know what's going on. In terms of story, but I mean it's still good because it shows you some great gameplay mechanics and it really shows you how just absolutely absurd this game is going to be. But I can't imagine this is the first level of the game.
Maybe if it isn't, they definitely re-engineered it to have the tutorial stuff in it.
Yeah,
because the enemies kind of wait around for you to do your combos on them.
Totally.
I would say that. You think about just how nuts this gameplay segment is. This is probably one of the first times I looked at a game and go, is my TV keeping up with this? Because this just looks like a blurry mess.
Really? It's crisp for me. I mean, it's like I can.
I mean, like it's like my brain can't process what I'm looking at. There's just
maybe
so
it's
much
not your TV
going
that's
on.
You know, problem, James.
I think I think it's just like the art direction as well as the speed because the creatures are so just out of this world.
Oh, yeah.
And so what am I looking at?
It's just chaos.
Yeah, exactly. So it moves really fast and smooth and I can keep up with the action, but it's what I'm attacking is just screwing with my brain.
Yeah.
What am I perceiving right now?
Busyness to it visually that actually reminds me a lot of Wonderful 101, which is not a big surprise, from the same developer on the same system. But I have to say, I mean, I think in Bayonetta, it is easier to follow what's going on because you don't have to follow 100 little dudes and the enemies stand out a little better, I think, in Bayonetta. And at least in the demo, I felt that it just controls better. It's easier to understand what you're supposed to do. And the little quick time cutscenes are a lot easier to succeed at. It's weird, but even just from this demo, I think I'm going to like Bayonetta 2 a lot better than Wonderful 101. It just feels tighter. It makes more sense. I mean, mechanically, it makes more sense. You know, I mean, artistically, it makes no kind of sense, which is obviously what they're going for. But I think it feels tight. And, you know, this game has been getting insane review scores. People really seem to be over the moon for it. And I don't know about you guys. I rented the first Bayonetta and played a couple stages of it and was like, okay, it's basically Devil May Cry. And I like those games, but I don't love them. And for me, it just, wasn't super interested in it. And so I sent it back, you know, but there's something that happens when you rent games like that where it's easier to give up on them because, you know, there's just,
right.
You're going to send me the next one in the queue. So if this doesn't grab me immediately, I don't have that much motivation to stick with it and really learn the systems and everything.
Yeah.
But given the critical response for Bayonetta 2 and based on the demo, it's tempting for me. I mean, once I get a job, kind of thing that I might jump into.
I'm exactly in the same boat as you. When the original Bayonetta came out, I was working at IGN, obviously not on the system, you know, not covering the system that it came out on. So I would borrow the PS3 version. Was it the PS3 version or the Xbox 360 version? I cannot remember.
The 360 was the good one. The PS3 right. one was someone else made.
Yeah, exactly. So it was that version. I played it, and yeah, I was in the same boat. I was like, this is a fun action game, but I can't really get into it. And maybe it was because I needed to bring it back the next day or whatever. But I was just, you know, just playing it and having a good time, but I didn't really kind of get engaged in all this stuff. But so I'm kind of going into Bayonetta 2, seeing all the coverage and, you know, knowing a little bit of what went behind the scenes on how Nintendo got it. You know, because I used to work at Sega, and, you know, during the time when they were still pitching it to Sega. So mm-hmm. I kind of got a little insight there. But I just wasn't super into the game, just seeing the coverage. I just didn't care too much because I didn't care about the first one that much. But I mean, but then the demo came out. I was like, oh yeah, I'll download it. It's free, whatever. And this is the first time a demo has ever gotten me to go, yeah, I'll buy it. Because honestly, it's like I'm playing it. I'm really getting into it and I'm understanding the mechanics and it just feels very tight. It's got that, you know, dodge and counter, you know, when you time it just right and you can really get, you know, wail on the enemies when they slow down, if you get the timing just right. And I think that just feels so nice. It still has that
it's
absurdity.
It's a cool mechanic too, right? It's got that risk reward thing where
oh, yeah.
you want to dodge, and if you can always dodge earlier, and at the very least, you'll dodge the attack most likely.
I don't know
but
if that's
you wait.
Yeah, the waiting risk, but it's still that, but you can, see, I don't know if it's super risky. It's certainly just a matter of mechanic, understanding the mechanic
well,
and doing it.
The risk is that you wait too long.
Yeah.
And the tough part is, and I think this kind of is the game, is that the enemies that you fight are so crazy and so varied that it's every time you meet a new enemy, you have to relearn its animation
yep.
patterns because that dictates when you're supposed to dodge.
Yeah.
And you have to relearn the timing and those patterns. And so, especially once they start mixing different kinds of enemies and the levels are, you know, you're upside down on a fighter plane or whatever, you know, you're going through this crazy camera, work. It's difficult to keep your eye on what you need to focus on in order to do those dodges correctly. And so I get the feeling that that is kind of the game.
Yeah,
and the
it really
scene,
is.
You can sort of button mash, and you know, I know that it is a deep combat system, and I'm interested in playing the full game where you can go to the store and buy different weapons and create all these crazy combinations and sort of set up the character to play the way you want to play it. But certainly in the demo, it feels like if you can get that witch time, if you can dodge just at the very last second, it doesn't really matter which attack buttons you use. I mean, some of them might kill the enemy faster than others. But that it sort of becomes your playground at that point. And to me, the interesting part of the gameplay seems to be more on the dodging side.
Yeah. And it's punch out. It's essentially what it is. There's going to be a ton of enemies with their own little attack patterns. And you figure out where you dodge and where you attack. And if you dodge at just the right moment, then you'll get that reward. Absolutely. But yeah, again, just the demo did a fantastic job of getting me to want to buy it. And yeah, I'm going to definitely download it when it comes out.
Yeah. And the fact that you get the first game too, especially for those of us who kind of pass over the first one, you know, maybe I play the second one and I get a more of an appreciation for what it's doing, and then I might very well be inclined to go back and play through the first one.
Yeah, I'm curious about that.
It's a good game also.
Well, it has to be a port, obviously, and so if what you say is true about the PS3 version being a not so good port of the original Bayonetta, no one is actually like looking at the original Bayonetta on the Wii U, whatever we're going to get.
I mean, there's a review of it on our site from the European or the Japanese version. Yeah, and it sounds like it's an upgrade over the original.
Good.
Runs better. It has new content. The graphics are a little bit sharper. Runs a little bit smoother than the original. So, if you like the first Bayonetta, it's probably the definitive version.
Well, that's great. I've not read anything, so it's good to hear. Because I was always curious, like, why is no one talking about the original Bayonetta? Because you're gonna get it. Well, at least if you have, I download all my games. I don't actually go out the stores and buy the disc.
Yeah.
I'm 100% digital, so I'm downloading the Bayonetta 2 on Wii U, but that doesn't come with it. You have to actually pay an extra $10 because the digital download of Bayonetta 2 is what, $49.99? And then if you do that, then you can buy Bayonetta 1 for $9.99. So.
Right. Yeah. Whereas I think on disc, they both come in the same package for $60.
Yes, exactly. Same amount of money,
Yeah. And on the flip side, if you only wanted to buy the first Bayonetta for some reason, you can download that for, I think, $30 on the eShop. So. I don't know why anybody would do that, but if you just want to sample it maybe and say, well, I don't know if I want to sink, the full $60 into both of these, but if it's almost like a trial version. You could play the upgraded version of the first one and see if you like it. And I think the discount works both ways, right?
So that would be interesting. It would bring the price down to $30 then for the other one?
I believe so, yeah. So either regardless of the order you buy them in on the eShop, you should be able to get both together for $60 if you choose to buy both.
Not shabby. Not
so
too
it's
shabby.
Pretty nice that Nintendo's handling it that way, even though the games aren't even priced the same in the first place. So, I look at this game and you were saying like knowing what's behind it. It's like, I try not to let that sort of influence my opinion of games, knowing the developers or knowing the story of how the game got made. But like, I think there's something to be said for knowing that this game is very clearly a labor of love. I mean, this is a game that Platinum desperately wanted to make and the people who have been working on it for the past few years probably went through a lot of times when they didn't think it would ever come out.
And
they kept working on it and it has this weird aura of like being almost an indie title. And then when you play the demo, it has these ridiculous production values. I mean, it looks like a really expensive modern Japanese video game. But that the people who made it, were almost making it for themselves.
And that's
it almost
totally
has
true.
Like that Mega Man 2 kind of quality where, it's like, it's not clear at all that there's an audience for this.
Well, it's
to justify the work put into it.
Yeah, it would not have existed if Nintendo didn't step in and do anything. I mean, that's 100% factual. I mean, I know it's gone on the record recently that's what happened, but I was at Sega when they said no. And then all of a sudden, it showed up on, at Nintendo's, I think it was one of their digital, what's their show called?
Nintendo Direct.
Nintendo Direct. They showed up on Nintendo Direct and went, hey, how about that? And they're like, yep. So, it was 100% Nintendo stepping in and going, yes, we want this an exclusive. So, I see a lot of people on the forums are like, they're bitching and moaning that this is an exclusive for Nintendo. And it's like, well, sure, they paid for it to show up on their system to begin with. And,
At this point, Bayonetta is basically a Nintendo franchise.
Yep. It's published by Nintendo. Their marketing is coming from Nintendo. Sega has their name on it, but I don't know how much, if Sega's Japan office had anything to do with it. I don't know, but, it's all Nintendo and Platinum.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's exciting. I'm definitely, my interest in the game went from almost zero to really high in the past couple weeks. And, a lot of it was reading reviews and talking to people who had played the full version, and then also the demo is very convincing, and especially having recently picked up Wonderful 101 when it went on sale on the eShop. Like I said, even from this small sample of Bayonetta 2, I feel like I already like it better than Wonderful 101, so that's really encouraging as well.
I have Wonderful 101. I have not beat it. I played through a bunch of it, but I have not I have not enjoyed it as much as I thought I would. So I'm hoping that
it's a really unforgiving game.
Yeah.
It's impressive in its own right, but it's a different kind of nonsense, and it's very difficult to follow what's going on. And that game in particular has a lot of scripted events where they seem to expect you to already know what to do. And Bayonetta 2 seemed to be the demo seemed to be a lot more overt about, hey, this is a quick time event. You need to push A really fast now. And if you don't, you just won't do as much damage to the boss, but it's not going to kill you. So it just seems to be a lot more forgiving of new players. And especially for a sequel, I'm impressed by that. But at the same time, you know, Platinum hasn't made a lot of sequels, and it's exciting to see them get a chance to refine a formula that was already pretty successful and very beloved by the people who really got into it. So, you know, for them to go back and sort of fix a few things and basically do things bigger, better, and crazier, it's appealing, you know, and I really like those guys. So, I'm impressed by it so far. All right. So, James, why don't we hear about your phone game? Because I think it might be more interesting than that intro makes it sound.
Well, I mean, yes, but it was kind of funny to hear the hype up of entering the holiday season. And actually, I have a year-old cell phone game. Partially in a desire to have something to talk about on the show that's not come up and that is uniquely something that on this show would probably be in my purview. And partially because I have this weird fetishization with making sure I play everything that has the Layton name on it at this point. I went ahead and downloaded the cell phone game Layton Brothers Mystery Room, which I didn't realize had actually come out on the Android store in English like a year ago.
I love how you say it's a cell phone game, like you're playing it on your flip phone Nokia.
It's true, though. Well, so I have a slide-out phone, so kinda, yeah. So it's, to be clear, if you don't know what this game is, which is probably everyone listening to the show, Level 5 put out a game for iOS and Android about a year ago in Japan, a little bit later in the West, that they threw the Layton name on because they thought it would sell more copies that way, which is probably true. Basically, it is a game where you play as the assistant to a detective who investigates murder scenes and fingers the criminal. That's it. That's the game.
Sounds like a Layton game to me.
Yeah. their connection, their incredibly tenuous connection is they just shrugged their shoulders and said, yeah, he's Layton's kid, whatever. And then that's like the only time they ever mention him.
Wow.
It's like, okay.
Does he even share the same like art style or like?
It does, but it in a weird, like it doesn't have kind of the semi hand drawn quality. It looks like, you know, in the mid 2000s when lots of cartoons were being made in Flash, like TV cartoons, it's kind of got like that version of the Layton character style.
Is it at least taking place in France?
It's taking place in London.
Okay. Isn't Layton kind of a French, like, mostly? No, see,
the funny thing about Layton is it's usually set in London, but it has a very French style to it.
Yeah, it's French animation and French musicality.
Yeah.
But it's set in London because I don't know. Or under London or above London or wherever. So this game is set. First off, I want to say that the takeaway that I took from this game immediately is how really, really good Treehouse is at localizing versus other people, because the writing in this game is terrible. Like they Cockney accented pretty much every character to the point where it's difficult to read.
Wow.
But, basically what you do is you come into the game breaks up every mystery into a chapter, and you get two free to start with, and then you can buy the other seven. I think if you were to buy them all, it would be about $6. But how it works is you get the introduction of what the murder was, and this detective Layton, he already knows who the killer is, but he doesn't tell you. He's just like, yeah, I know it is, but I'm going to give you the rundown, let you figure it out. So they introduce a handful of suspects, the conditions of the murder, and then you get the opportunity to move around the crime space like a diorama and basically do hidden objects game with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not.
That sounds more like Phoenix Wright.
To an extent, but it's not quite. It's how it differs as opposed to Phoenix Wright, where they just show you an area and you kind of have to figure out, that looks a little weird. I should look into that. You can zoom in and out of specific zones on the room that you're in. And as you zoom in and out, it'll highlight things you can interact with. It'll actually show you where they are. And when you've clicked everything, it'll check off that part of the room. So there's a very limited number of things to look at. And each item has a description. And then as you progress, you get to speak to the suspect, and then you try to find contradictions with the evidence. So that way it is very Phoenix Wright-ish. And ultimately the goal is to get them to confess to the murder. Figure out who did it and then make them confess. Mechanically, it's simple. It was very hand-holdy for the first two chapters, but I mean, that may just be because they are the first two chapters. But there was a certain amount of thinking that I had to do to kind of make the jump to figure out where things were. So it's been an interesting experience. I think because the next chapter set is like four chapters for $2, I might just go ahead and buy them just to see. But
would you have bought this if it wasn't a Leighton game?
No, absolutely not.
And, so you got suckered. Is this really a Leighton game, though? Yeah. It sounds like
no,
it's kind of Leighton.
No, absolutely not. It's not
name,
a Leighton game.
In name only.
I wouldn't have tried it if somebody described it to me if it wasn't the Leighton game. Let's put it that way. Would I have bought it after playing the demo for $2? Maybe. I mean, it's to a certain extent. I think it's $2.
Okay. So it's not the miscarriage of branding that like CDI Zelda is.
No.
It's still okay. Level 5 though, right? I mean, they made this game, right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Yes, Level 5 made this game. Their name is all the hell over it.
Yeah, they tend to make good things.
So yeah, I mean that's part of it. Like I accept that Level 5 makes games I like, so I'm willing to give this thing a chance. I didn't realize it'd even come out on Android in the West, so I'd never even attempted to download it. I just happened to cross it the other day, going, "Oh, sup."
Okay.
So it's not great, but it's there is a certain amount of, you know, deductive reasoning stuff that I kind of enjoy that I got out of it. So while there are some real concessions to, you know, making it fairly straightforward to play, it is, you know, it did get an hour out of two chapters. So certainly, you know, for $2 I'll get four more chapters, whatever. That's not a terrible proposition, so I'm okay with it.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we move on to what Craig's been playing?
Ooh, what have I been playing? Well, I mean, you guys probably talked to death about Smash Brothers.
Not as much as you might think, because I'm the only one of the usual crew who actually has bought it so far.
Wait, what? Are you kidding me? Like, isn't it kind of you need to have, if you have a 3DS, you have to have a copy of the game, right? I mean, that's
you
just
know, you
kinda
go to war with the army that you have, Craig.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a huge Smash Brothers fan, but I'm not a good Smash Brothers player. So, in my own bubble, I'm good, and probably in the, you know, like the local, you know, when I was at IGN, I was pretty good, but I have not practiced up at all, since the Wii version. So I'm, you know, playing this game. It's probably not the best platform to play Smash Brothers, you know, cause, of the controls itself. You know, you got it's completely functional on the handheld. You got the analog stick and the buttons and all that stuff, but it's like, I guess big meaty hands and they keep slipping out of my fingers and, you know, so I can't really play as professionally as I could if I was, you know, like battling other people. But no, it's mm-hmm. it's a fantastic rendition of Smash Brothers, and I cannot wait to see what it looks like on the Wii U in its final form. Just based on just experiencing Smash Brothers for the last month and the next month, and then, you know, seeing it on the big screen finally, and it's just going to be amazing. The game plays fantastically if you can deal with the controls. The online component, when it works really well. And the local multiplayer aspect is awesome. When I was playing, you know, when I was at EA, in our division, we have a bunch of people that have the 3DS. And in fact, I got a bunch of people to buy 3DSs simply because I kept bringing my 3DSs in, not just for Smash Brothers, but because of street passing. It's like, you know, people would see it. Yeah. Right. Like some people are like, what are you doing with that 3DS? I'm street passing and I'm doing all this stuff. It's like, maybe I should be doing that. And so they would buy a 3DS. And so I think I got at least two people buying 3DS simply just to do the street passing part, but I digress. The Smash Brothers, I probably only played 2 days worth in the office because we got other things to worry about, you know, at work. It's not the best time to bring out a system when we're working on other things, but no. Smash Brothers, I've unlocked pretty much almost all the characters. I don't think I've unlocked Ganondorf yet.
Okay. Yeah, he's one of the last ones, oddly enough.
But it's actually sitting here right next to me, my system and my housemate's system. Because I came in last night and he had set up our systems to be on an infinite battle online. Because I guess there's some sort of achievement to being 50 hours online. So it's now it's still sitting here like it's Yoshi versus Bowser sitting on Final Destination, just them looking at each other, and it's been on for almost 24 hours now.
Oh, geez. So. Yeah, I remember doing that on Melee because there was a character that, in order to unlock the character, you had to have the game turned on for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, so yeah, this is it's still connected online. I'm sitting here on Skype, and it's still online. It actually disconnected a couple times last night because I was. I have Comcast, so I can watch TV in my bedroom on my iPad. Like I can watch live television. And I guess that knocked it offline because it just used so much bandwidth. But for the most part, yeah, it's still like about 24 hours in. They're still online, just looking at each other.
Well, at some point, you might want to
thrilling.
Exactly. Jump out of there to check it because you're not going to get the achievement until the match is over.
Oh, of course. Well, I mean, it keeps getting knocked out when it disconnects anyway. So I'm sure that that's given me credit. But this is my housemate's doing. I'm only helping him along. So I don't care. I really don't care.
It's good to know that we're using Earth's resources responsibly.
But yeah, so I'm playing that, off and on because it's a handheld. On the, console, I'm playing Alien Isolation. I have a little history on that one because, when I was at Sega, I was in charge, well, not in charge, but like certainly I was working on the Alien franchise for Sega, with 20th Century Fox and Gearbox. That was for Aliens Colonial Marines, but we were also working on Alien Isolation while Gearbox was working on this game. And so I worked on this game a little bit, for marketing, not in any game design, but I did have some, input every once in a while, but I don't know how much of it got into the game, but, it was really early when we were working on it. I, helped the E3 demos when they were showing it behind closed doors. But yeah, when Aliens Colonial Marines didn't perform well on the market, that's when I got laid off. And so I didn't get a chance to really work on this game as much as I wanted to. And I was really excited to. I mean, I was reading the scripts and, working briefly with 20th Century Fox on getting approvals and stuff like that. But, what the final product is not what I was playing, 2 years ago. I'm still surprised at some things, like when things are happening, it's like, I didn't expect it to happen, but it is, so that said, I might have a little bit of bias towards this game simply because I was excited to work on it. But, playing it, it's one of the best horror games I've ever played. I generally don't, get startled. And I don't like horror games too much anyway. I don't like Resident Evil. I don't like going to horror movies just to get scared. I don't find getting scared a fun experience. But since I love the Alien franchise, it makes sense to be just the tension, this thing is hunting you out and you're like, trapped in a locker waiting for him to walk away so you can escape. It's just all that tension stuff it's a really good game mechanic, and it's probably I've never seen it done so well as it is in Alien Isolation.
Yeah, we should probably say this game is, unlike Colonial Marines, which was based on the sequel Aliens, which is the action, crazy James Cameron action movie thing, which I like a lot as well, but Isolation is more based on the first movie.
Yes.
Alien, which is, I think a movie that most people know of and have maybe seen at some point, but, it's one of those things, if you saw it, part of it when you were a kid or a teenager, you might not remember that it's really more of a horror movie than it is a science fiction movie.
Yes.
And that the whole movie is just dripping with dread, and you very rarely see the alien. I mean, it's 1979, and the production design is outstanding, which I've heard is replicated beautifully in this game. All the crappy old black and green CRTs. Yeah.
I don't think the game would have weird low tech futuristic
tech.
Think this sequel would have worked as well as it does if they didn't do that. Going with Prometheus, for example, the future tech that they're using, like if you went from Prometheus to Alien, because that's the order of the movie, right? It's Prometheus takes place before Alien, but all the tech and all the visual displays and all that stuff, is superior to what's in Alien simply because they could do more with the tech that they have today, right? Similar to a prequel of the prequel to Star Wars, right? The first episode 1, 2, and 3, like all the ships are sleeker and cooler and better designed than they are in episode 4, 5, and 6. But why aren't the ships as cool in 4, 5, and 6 if they were in 1, 2, and 3. So I think that in, you know, Alien Isolation, they did a really good job of sticking to what the tech was in the 1977 Alien movie, right? I mean, with all the buttons that are blinking on the walls and the CRT televisions. Exactly. And you know, they you accept this world because it is what it was in 1977, future tech. And it seems like it's
similarly reserved about how it uses the alien, because I haven't played the game at all, but I watched the Giant Bomb Quick Look, or at least I kind of flipped through it, and I was interested. You know, it's that thing that's an hour long video of them playing the game, and I flipped through it, and it could be that it happened very quickly and I missed it, but I was looking for the alien encounter and never found it.
Well,
and there were a couple places where they were hiding and you could hear it nearby, but I kind of wanted to see, hey, what does this thing look like in the game, and what, you know, what is it like when it catches you and it kills you? And I never even saw that happen. Well, so it seems like it's pretty rare.
Well, it is, but I will say that's probably one of my biggest criticisms. It there's a ton of setup at the beginning, so you're going about maybe an hour or 2 hours, you know, without even knowing that the alien exists. Even though, like, you as a gamer know the alien exists, but the characters do not. So it's kind of annoying that they're just like, you know, you're getting the setup for the characters themselves. It's kind of like, you know, seeing the movie Godzilla, the new one that came out, and it's like, it's an hour before you even see Godzilla, and the movie's called Godzilla. Why does it take so long to get to Godzilla?
The same thing applies, though, to the original Alien movie as well. But I would say, you know, an hour in movie time is very different than an hour in game time.
You know what, though? But the thing is, like, in context, though, when you see the movie Alien, you don't know why it's called Alien. They're in space. So obviously there's maybe, and when they get on the planet, when they get LV-426, they get, you know, they see the, you know, the facehuggers or the eggs or whatever. So, I mean, you get to the alien pretty quickly, or whatever the alien starts out at.
Right. Yeah. It's a different version of it, but yeah, that's fair.
It takes a while to get to it. And that's my biggest criticism. And it's not really that big of a criticism, because they make you engaged. Well, even without the alien, and that's kind of where this game goes, right? So you're exactly right. It's very rare when you see the alien. But if you see the alien, you're screwed. It's just the way, there's no pattern to the alien. He's just hunting you out, by sensing, seeing you, or by hearing you, or by feeling you out. He's just going, through his AI. There is no pattern. So you can't guess what he's going to do. If you run, he'll hear you and he'll come after you. You can't outrun him. If you manage to sneak into a locker, you can see him sneak past you. And if he hears you breathing, he'll know where you are and he'll try and hunt you out. And if he hears you breathing even just a second after that, then he'll rip the doors right off your locker and grab you.
So is there like a sniper button to hold your breath?
Yes, there actually is. So like when you're in the locker, you hit the L3 button. I'm playing on the PS4, so you hit the L3 button and you'll hold your breath. And if you hold it too long, it'll start pulsing red, and then you have to exhale, and it's a loud exhale, so the alien will hear you. So it's creepy, eerie, and just the tension is just super high, but it's a fun tension, and it's frustrating. I see a lot of reviews out there that are like, oh, it's too hard. There's no pattern to the alien. I spent so long on one level because the alien just, you know, I didn't know what the alien was going to do, and that's the whole point of the game, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, if you're trying to rush through the game, you're never going to finish it.
Yeah, I think video games have been really bad about training us to be so pattern based. You know, when you see an enemy in the game, especially, you expect, you know, like if there's a boss, you say, well, you know, if I didn't beat the boss on the first try, that's okay, because I learned his pattern. I go back, and the second time it'll be easy. And when you run into games where that's not the case, it can be really frustrating. It's part of why, you know, I think Dark Souls, for instance, or at least I've been playing Dark Souls 2, and that game's really tough because those enemies are more reactive to what you're doing. And they do have AI routines that are, you know, exploitable if you know what to do. But the game's so complicated also that it's a lot of times very difficult to find the right combination of things. It sounds like in Alien Isolation, the gameplay stuff that you can do is fairly limited. And so a lot of it is maybe just learning to be patient.
Oh, there's no, it's not limited gameplay. It's simply, I mean, you still have, you can pick up a gun, you can use it, but the alien is pretty much invincible. And even in the other enemies that you encounter, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but there are other enemies that are not alien. And they're pretty strong too. And so like using the pistol is not a good idea because it makes a lot of noise and they'll just come after you. And so like you can craft items that will create noise. So you can lob noisemakers away from you that will draw attention that helps you out so you can escape. There's a lot of stuff going on here. It's just not a first person shooter. Even though it takes place in a first person and there are guns that you can pick up and use. It's just a completely different
experience. Is it more about just running and hiding? Is that usually
what you're not running? I mean, you can run, but if you run, you're dead.
Sneaking.
It's very sneaky. Yes. It's very stealth oriented. It's, you're trying to go from point A to point B, but it's how you do it to get from point A to point B. Cause in the way is going to be these, probably the strongest and hardest enemies to defeat. And you're never going to defeat the strongest enemy, which is the alien. I don't know how the game ends because I haven't beat it yet, but there's just no way to defeat the alien.
You'll probably have to shove it out of an airlock.
Likely.
Or maybe they'll let you climb into one of those crazy mech suit power lifter things.
Well, that's the second one. Right. That's aliens. So that's not, doesn't exist yet.
I think
yet.
They do it a little bit at the end of the first movie.
No, not
I think in the final scene there might be one, but.
She's just in a spaceship. She's just in a spacesuit. So that's all it is.
Okay. Yeah. So it's been probably a decade since I saw Alien, and actually just today it came in on Blu-ray from Netflix, and I'm going to invite some friends over and hopefully we're going to watch it. Cause you know, tis the season.
Oh, absolutely. And, Alien is.
I remember I saw that movie on DVD back at kind of in the early days of DVD, and I was astonished at how good it looked for such an old movie.
And
I'm really excited
still
to see
does.
It. And,
yeah, exactly. It's one of the best science fiction movies out there. Alien and Aliens are both, like, they hold up so well, and they're completely different movies. And so, like, I just feel so bad for people who have never seen it. You know, like, working on the Aliens franchise, I got that a lot going to events and stuff like that. They never saw Aliens, or they never saw Alien. And it's like, no, you stop, you go home right now, you go rent the disc, both discs, back to back, see them both. And
they really are great movies.
You absolutely have to see those movies. They hold up so well.
I like 3 too. I know 3 gets shit on a lot, but
3 is all right. 4 is a disaster.
Yeah. Yes. No, yeah. No doubt. All right. Well, actually keeping on the same theme, I'm going to follow up with my new business. And, I've been playing a little bit, not a ton, but a little bit of Lone Survivor, which, I got as a PS Plus game on Vita. But as of this week, actually, it's now available in the director's cut on Wii U. So I think this will be relevant for some people. And it is a horror game and in the month of October. So it might be a game you want to check out on Wii U. I know for that version, they added quite a bit of new content. There's some new expanded scenes and different areas to go to and new dialogue and I think a couple of different endings. So, you know, that I haven't gotten far enough to know how much it really needed extra content. I don't know how long the game is, but so far it's pretty compelling stuff. It's a pretty interesting little game, at least the original version on Vita that I'm playing. So it's a 2D side-scrolling horror game with very pixel-based graphics. And that is a tricky thing to pull off, I have to imagine. I mean, it just... When you look at the intro screen, it just seems like there's no way that they can make this game scary. Cause it looks like an NES game, basically. I mean,
well,
it looks like
they?
Maniac Mansion.
Did they make it scary?
I would say, I don't, you know, again, I'm maybe only an hour into it. So maybe some of the stuff that it does, I haven't seen yet, but it's certainly very unsettling and creepy. At the very least, it pulls off an atmosphere that, you know, I mean, and you can play this on a bunch of different consoles and on your computer as well. But I mean, I'm playing it on Vita and even on a handheld, it's pretty creepy. You know, I'm really impressed by how they pull it off. So even though the graphics are pixel based, pixel art based, they are very dark. The game is extremely dark and it actually has a kind of dynamic lighting. Your character has a flashlight on his chest that you can turn on and off with a button. And, and it runs on batteries, so you don't want to use it all the time. Some places you don't need it because some places the lights are on and you don't need it. But, you know, in dark places, you kind of have to decide whether or not it's worth it because you can turn that light on. You can see way better. Sometimes there's things you can interact with that you can only use if the light is on because it'll say, well, I can't pick that up because I can't see it. So sometimes you have to turn the light on to do things, but then that attracts enemies and it uses up your battery. So you end up playing parts of the game in, you know, mostly dark screens and you can sort of barely see your character moving around. And that stuff is really like surprisingly effective. And, the music is also like super, super creepy. I mean, it's all very ambient, horror movie type stuff, but it's extremely well done. And the whole game just has this really like morose vibe to it. The story, the way that the writing is done, the way the characters move around is all very, it's not a happy game at all. I mean, there's been some kind of disease. Your character actually wears like a mask, you know, like a surgical mask, and you're walking around and the game doesn't give you a whole lot of background on how things got this way or what's really going on, but apparently you're trapped in your apartment building. You're trying to get out and escape, and it's full of these monsters that look kind of like do you remember I can't remember what they're called now, but the monsters towards the end of Resident Evil 4 when you're on the island and you have to sort of use like an X-ray scope in order to find their weak points. But they look like these kind of featureless,
they're white,
naked pink people walking around and they shuffle around in a way that's very creepy, and they don't make a lot of sound actually. They don't make a lot of groaning, and they don't sound like zombies. They don't really look like zombies. They maybe move that way, but they sort of roam these hallways. You can attract them with rotting meat, and you can get by them. Of course, it's a 2D game, right? So you can't jump over them or just, you know, take it. Sometimes you can take a different path. But usually the way that I found is you can either try to shoot them with your gun, which may be a bad idea if there's multiple enemies. If there's just one, you can probably kill it before it attacks you. But a lot of cases, there'll be like a recess in the wall in the background, and you have to time things correctly so that you can jump into the recess and then sidle in the shadows past the enemy while he's distracted by a piece of meat or some other thing. And there's a real tension when you're hiding in those shadows and you're sort of sliding by this thing and you're wondering, am I even allowed to move? Like, you know, I don't know how good this thing's hearing is. I don't know what I'm allowed to do here. And the game seems to have a lot of rules in terms of how the stealth works, and your character has like energy levels and hunger levels and things like that you can either go to take a nap and eat food, or you can just feed him pills in order to keep on playing. So apparently there's definitely a lot of different solutions to the different puzzles and problems that they present you with. And apparently the decisions you make in terms of how you decide to solve these problems has some kind of effect down the road. And I haven't played deep enough into the game to really see that stuff, but it wouldn't surprise me. It seems to be very well thought out, and it's definitely going for a kind of atmosphere that you don't often see in this kind of game. And, so far I've been pretty impressed with it. So I'd say, you know, if you're looking for something on Wii U and you want something seasonal, this might be a good way to go. I can't fully give it a recommendation yet just because I feel like I've really only scratched the surface of it, but it's an interesting game, and it's mostly, I would say, kind of like a point and click adventure style thing. It's a lot of, you know, picking up inventory items, exploring the map, looking for shortcuts and ways to, you know, get through doors that are locked and things like that. So it seems to be kind of puzzly, but it has these survival systems in the background where you kind of have to make sure your character doesn't get so exhausted or so hungry that he starts to hallucinate and makes things even worse than they already are. So monitoring that stuff and exploring a little bit at a time, you know, trying to suss out this world and how things are put together. I found it really interesting so far.
Nice.
And then I've been playing a couple of GBA games I can talk about. These aren't nearly as depressing as Lone Survivor. But I've been enjoying catching up with Castlevania Circle of the Moon on the Wii U. And Craig, I'm sure you have lots of memories of playing this back in your days at IGN.
Well, I think memories is so long ago.
I know, it's been 13 years since this game came out.
My biggest memory is obviously I couldn't see the game on the original system. It was so dark.
Yeah. My memory is being like curled up on a love seat or something in my parents' house under the brightest lamp that I could find in the entire house, and still like having trouble keeping the angle of the screen right so that I could really see it best. Cause, you know, I get that it's a Castlevania game and they wanted it to be kind of dark and atmospheric. But on that game, on the original GBA screen, I mean, you really just couldn't see the game very well at all. And it was a real challenge to even play it. And on the Wii U version, I don't know what all they're doing, but it's hard to believe that was ever an issue because the game is, it really pops out. I mean, it's very bright. It's colorful. It's extremely easy to look at. You know, the technology is different, but it seems like maybe they've even adjusted the color palette of the game and the way it's displayed through the emulator, because it doesn't look like it is even that dark. You know, the color palette doesn't even look that dark. So I'm really surprised by how it looks.
Well, the problem was definitely the fact that the original GBA, because it didn't have a backlight, it was all reflective TFT. So there was no actual white. You could not do a white color. Because like white is all the colors, you know, like that sucking up all the wavelengths to make that white color, and you just couldn't do it with that technology. It was just a off white gray, and that just kind of throws off the color palettes of if you want to do a dark game,
right?
And so yeah, but I mean, like when you play it on a backlit GBA, it's fine. Like the, you know, not the front light, the one that you, so remember when they brought out the GBA, like the last generation when the DS just came out? Not the micro. Well, I mean, they around the same time as the micro, they
refreshed the
SP. Yeah. So you actually had a backlight and you can actually adjust it.
It's the same screen as on the micro, but bigger on the SP version 2 or whatever they call it.
Yeah. Play Circle of the Moon on that thing. It's perfectly fine. They didn't do any, obviously, because when you play the cartridge, it's, they're not adjusting anything. It's simply just the original code. So it's simply because the old tech wasn't capable of displaying all the colors that they wanted the color to display in Circle of the Moon.
It makes me wonder about playtesting. Like, were they playtesting on debug hardware? What were they doing? Like, at some point, somebody should have gone, dude, I can't see this game.
Yeah, maybe one of those old Fat Boy things.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
plugged into an N64.
Like, somebody.
Well, they did. Well, they. I think they did.
I guess
that
was for GB Color, though.
No, they had. We had at IGN. We used something called the AGB Capture, and what that's essentially a Game Boy Advance in, you know, it's like this gray box, and then you can plug. It has Super Nintendo video outs that you send to your TV, and so maybe they're playtesting on that, and they're like, "Yeah, it looks fine. Yeah, no problems," you know, but not actually looking at it on a real GBA screen.
Right. Yeah. Well, anyway, the game obviously looks fine now. I mean, it looks like an early GBA game, but it looks actually a little better than I was expecting. And the music is good too, but, I've been impressed by just how well it plays. You know, I've played Symphony of the Night fairly recently on my Vita, and that game, in terms of control, it doesn't hold up all that well to the test of time. Symphony of the Night is one of my favorite games ever, and I still enjoy playing it, but it's a little stiff and clunky when you play it, and there's definitely a refinement in Circle of the Moon. It feels a little snappier right out of the gate, and of course you're back to using the whip, and coming off of last week playing Dracula X, which is, you know, an abomination as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the Circle of the Moon plays way better than that game. It just feels nice right off the bat. And I had remembered nothing about the progression, because this is one of those, you know, Metroid inspired Castlevania games, and really one of the earliest examples. And very, very, very close to the beginning of the game, you get a dash upgrade, which the character's normal movement is a little bit slow for my taste, but the fact that you can double tap left or right to dash, it alleviates that problem quite a bit, and you get that very quickly. And then, like, less than half an hour into the game, I got the double jump. And all of a sudden I feel like, oh wow, I really feel like I have a lot of control over this character. And so the fact that the game is easy to play and it has that kind of accessible character movement that is not always the case in the Castlevania series, it makes it feel very accessible, What's a little bit tougher is just getting around the map. I mean, the layout, especially for the very beginning of the game, it doesn't seem to be directing you very much at all. And it's a tough balance with this sort of open exploration game in terms of giving you options, but also sort of gently guiding you towards the next major objective, you know, or at least one of the possible next things that you might do. And Circle of the Moon, the map feels really big for how much stuff is in it. There's just a lot of long corridors and long vertical shafts that you're in that it's not really clear that they're leading to anywhere of importance for a long time. And even after the second major boss where I got the tackle maneuver, I was just looking everywhere and I could not figure out where the hell I'm supposed to go next. The ability that I got didn't seem to open up anything useful. And finally, I had to go to GameFAQs and I was surprised on the Wii U. I didn't know this. Maybe this is really common knowledge, but if you're playing a virtual console game on the Wii U and you go to the home screen and go open up the browser, it'll suggest a search key for the title of the game that you have suspended.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I open up the Wii U browser and it says, do you want to search for Circle of the Moon? I was like, as a matter of fact, I do. And of course, GameFAQs is the second link that comes up. And so I go there and I finally figure out it's the map is so tiny I have it in pixel perfect mode. So this might be on me for wanting to look at it in that way and not expanding it out to be a little bit bigger. But there was a little tiny place on the map, near one of the warp points that basically it's a room that I had gone into and then I couldn't get through the block. And so I had backed out and now I had the ability to get through that block, but I can't see on the map. I can't actually tell that room was partially explored.
Actually sounds very familiar. I've played so many handheld Castlevania games over, you know, like there were a bunch on GBA and a bunch on DS. So I can't really remember which one it was that what you're describing sounds so familiar to me. Like that I've revealed the entire map and I'm like, where the hell am I supposed to go? And it's like, oh, there's that one little pixel that is not revealed. That's the door to where you need to go. Oh, and if you don't see it, yeah.
It's tough. And yeah, I mean, that kind of thing, it sounds like playing it on a big screen should alleviate that problem because the map should be easier to read when you're looking at a TV versus a little handheld screen. But I still had the same problem. And that, I don't know if that's maybe the visual design of the map just doesn't make it, you know, because it's on a black background, but then when you explore somewhere, it turns purple, but it's kind of a dark purple. So those two colors are so close to each other that it's a little bit hard to tell the difference. And I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. But anyway, so I just finally figured out where the hell I'm supposed to go. And now I'm ready to go explore the rest of the castle. But anyway, it's a really fun game. The card system is kind of broken and also a little bit frustrating in that, you know, these cards that you use for magic powers that can dramatically affect the game. It can make it play very differently, can make your character much, much more powerful. They drop based on a random number generator. So the game is a lot based on luck. And in fact, I'm spending a good portion of the game playing with an ability that just boosts my luck stat, because then that makes it more likely that the enemies will drop more cards and then I'll get more abilities. So I feel like it's a little broken in that sense. And also a lot of the enemies, drop equipment that will boost your stats also, but the game has such a very limited number of pieces of equipment that the enemies end up dropping the same crap over and over. So I have like 12 wristbands and 8 leather armors in my inventory that I have absolutely no use for. There's no one for me to sell them to. There's no way to discard them. It's just kind of pointless junk. You know, it's like in the intro to Wayne's World where he says, I have an extensive collection of name badges and hairnets. That's kind of how I feel running around Circle of the Moon, because I just have all this junk that enemies are dropping that has no purpose whatsoever. But it's really fun to play. The bosses are excellent, and I'm excited to go through it again. It's been so very long since I played it that I'm really pleased that this is coming out. Now, if people are wondering which one of these is the best, you know, they're releasing 3 GBA Castlevanias in 3 weeks on Wii U. They're all worth playing in my opinion, but the best one by far is Aria of Sorrow. and that's coming out next week. So if you're interested in only picking up one of those, Aria of Sorrow is maybe my favorite Castlevania game of all time. Nice. It is so, so, so good. I've beaten it several, several times. And I think it will hold up extremely well. So if you only want to get one, that's probably the one to go with. But Circle of the Moon is not bad at all. In fact, it holds up better than I even expected.
That's good to know.
I'm glad for the chance to play through it again.
It's been years since I played those games. So it's just like I saw it on the eShop going, do I want to buy this again? Or do I want to buy it so that, you know, I can play through it again? I don't know. But it's good to hear your story. So it makes me want to kind of just, because I don't remember. It's been so long that I played these games, plowed through it. It's like, it was a launch title on the GBA. Yeah. And so, like, I'm just like, I had to plow through a whole bunch of games. I just don't have the recollection of what made it awesome. I just remember it was a really, really good game.
And you and I are in a similar boat on there, Craig, because you and I were both reviewing these games at the same time when they first originally came out. And, you know, like on GBA, I didn't necessarily go back and replay a lot of those games because there was always a new one coming out. You know, so yeah. I was reviewing so many games back then that I didn't really keep a huge back catalog that I would go back and revisit all the time. So Circle of the Moon, it really had been a very long time for me, and it's, I think it's well worth going back to. Okay, so John is still having a little bit of trouble, but it sounds like he's making progress. We're going to go ahead and cut to a break, and when we come back, hopefully we'll have John Lindemann here to help us answer some of your emails. So stick around. We'll be back in a minute.
It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview. Super Smash Bros. On the new 3DS. Straight off the hard streets of Denden Town comes our own Danny Bivens, a man with a shiny new 3DS and a chip on his shoulders. If you dare to knock it off, he'll tell you all about how the new Smash Bros. Looks on the new portable. Yes, I know. This joke is getting old.
All right, we also have a video on Nintendo World Report TV, a new feature on the site, relatively new. Rare 64 Episode 1 Killer Instinct Gold. Neil Ronahan digs into the history of the much-beloved Killer Instinct franchise and how it wound up on the Nintendo 64. Ever wonder why Killer Instinct Gold looked worse on N64 than in the arcade despite being on roughly the same hardware?
No.
You'll find out here. Combo Breaker!
Another video on Nintendo World Report TV, Nintendo Game Pads Episode 1. John Raritan takes us on a trip down memory lane and introduces us to Nintendo's horrible revolutionary original consoles that came out way before the NES. You youngins might want to buckle up in the knowledge mobile and get you some learning here.
That's something he says in the video. Buckle up. We're hopping in the knowledge mobile.
Dear God, what is he, Miss Frizzle? Jesus Christ.
I thought it was kind of funny. All right, and we got a feature. From Sketch to Game, Exploring the World of Skylanders, our own Kim Keller recently visited the Toys for Bob office in California. Novato, California, actually, if you're wondering where.
Do you want to get the address, John? Maybe we can all go there and just pay him a surprise visit?
Yeah, maybe. And comes back with an in-depth account of their design process. Even a cynical old bastard like me has to admit that the home of Skylanders is pretty magical. And you'll want to read this to see where the magic happens.
Oh my God!
Sorry,
it's just they've just plastered the walls with money. Is that what? Is that why it's magical?
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's magical. It actually is a really good article. Please check it out. It's cool.
We have yet another video on Nintendo World Report TV. NES Rewind. Want to see Zack and Andy play Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on the NES? No? You're gonna see it anyway. Also, check out Patrick and Neil playing SNES Goof Troop. Man, I miss those old SNES Capcom games. Or any Capcom games, really. I mean, hey, John, this isn't in the script. I'm going to ask you, because I mentioned it in the forums, and I don't know that people have really thought about this. How many original games has Capcom published in North America this year? I say original, that means not like new versions of Street Fighter 4 or ports of games.
You know, every single thing that comes to mind is a sequel.
Not even a sequel, like a remake or a port, like a straight pure sequel. I will accept.
I can't even think of one.
You're right, because there haven't been any.
Oh, Capcom, where have you gone?
Miss you, Capcom.
All right, and finally we have a review, actually reviews, plural, of Bayonetta 2. Kim and Don tag team the North American and European versions of this long-awaited orgy of sex violence. Nah, it's not that bad, but you may see the odd side boob. A kid, sorta. Anyways, check out what they thought about this controversial title.
All this and more. Damn it, Sean, the first thing finishes. You can get all this and more of this at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back. It is time for listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We've got three really good ones for you this week, and James is going to read the first one.
Tripon writes, so IGN's Nintendo Voice podcast recently had former Factor 5 president Julian Egebrecht on to talk about the history of Factor 5 and the Rogue Squadron franchise. Among the other things Julian revealed was that there was a completed version of all three Rogue Squadron games, Rogue Squadron, Rogue Leader, and Rebel Strike, with updated controls and new levels for Wii. This game was completed and never released because LucasArts are a bunch of pansies that don't like to make money, despite the fact that it would have come out sometime in 2008 or 2009 if Lucas would have just published the damn thing during the height of Wii popularity. Anyway, what is the canceled game or franchise that was completed or near completion that you know of that you would really like to see released and play? Could somebody say Mother 64 or Star Fox 2?
I'll say Star Fox 2. I actually played that thing at the E3. I think it was the E3. It was Summer CES that they showed off Donkey Kong Country and Super Punch-Out, and they had Star Fox 2 kind of on its own little kiosk. I'm like, hell yeah.
Yeah, and ultimately that demo got dumped.
Instead it was hell no.
Yeah, I mean, that a bunch of different builds of Star Fox 2 have been dumped. Either they were smuggled out of Nintendo or whatever. So I've played this weird, like, hacked together version of like four or five different demo builds that just feel incredibly disjointed. But I mean, it's, you get a feel for what they were going for.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to, what's his name? Dylan Cuthbert over at Q Games.
Sure.
When he was working on the Star Fox, DS game. What was it called? Was it just Star Fox DS? Can't remember.
No, it's Command.
Command, thank you. And so yeah. Like a lot of the ideas they had in Star Fox 2, he put into Star Fox Command. I mean, the last time I played Star Fox 2 was literally at that CES. I know that it's on the web. I just refuse to download and play it. I don't know why. Maybe I just don't want to sully my memory of how awesome the original Super Nintendo.
Fair.
Yeah. But yeah. So he's actually said, yeah, there's a lot of what was in Star Fox 2 is in the DS game. So I think that's kind of cool.
So Craig, I'm going to bet that you could probably bring up a lot of obscure, almost complete games that you played while you were at IGN.
Oh,
you
sure.
Had so much access back then. But, you know, I just to speak to this Rogue Leader trilogy thing, that would probably be my choice because Mother 64, Earthbound 64 was never that close to being finished. It was, being made for 64DD. It had a lot of problems. They never were like on the cusp of releasing it or anything like that. The game just simply was not finished. They put it on the shelf and then they essentially brought back the story and some of the character art and things like that for Mother 3. So that game was finished eventually. They just made it for Game Boy Advance and they called it Mother 3 instead of Mother 64. It was exciting at the time because, hey, it's an RPG for N64. As we discussed recently, that was such a rare breed.
Yes.
You know, the idea of a good RPG on that system was incredibly exciting, but it was not meant to be at the time. But the Rogue Leader trilogy, that would be mine, especially I saw the videos that were leaked after Julian's appearance on the podcast.
Yeah, it's like an anonymous source a week after Julian shows up on the IGN Nintendo Voice Guys podcast.
Who could it be?
But I will say I do want to address one thing that bothers me about this email is there are a bunch of pansies that doesn't like to make money, and
that's
LucasArts is not that, and in fact Lucas is one of the companies that if it's a guaranteed moneymaker, he's going to do it, like re-release the movies, whatever. But no, in this case, the Wii was doing well, but it was not the hardcore games that were selling. And I don't know what the decisions were, but I mean, if you actually look at it from the perspective of, okay, you get this game, you put in so much time and development into this game, and then you got to print the discs because this is before digital distribution. So you still have to get it out in stores, and it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars just to do that. And then if they look at the dollars and cents and they're looking at it and going, we're not going to make our money back, they're not going to do it.
Well, and it's not that this game didn't have the sales potential. It's bad timing. If this game had been finished 6 months earlier, it probably would have come out.
Sure.
But as Julian was described on the podcast, and it is a fantastic episode, that podcast, of course, Craig was the host for a long time. I think Jose's been doing a really, really excellent job lately on that podcast, and it's become a weekly must-listen show for me. And I think if people enjoy our show, they will probably enjoy Nintendo Voice Chat. So I think you should check that out and listen to that episode with Julian, because it is just an hour and a half of him telling great, great stories about games that you know and love. But, he said it was the financial crisis at the end of 2008, and LucasArts all of a sudden was super broke and going out of business, and they had severe management dysfunction. And at the time, they said, we cannot, it was a weird situation. Factor 5 had self-funded the development of that game, even though it was clearly, could only be published by LucasArts given the situation with Star Wars at the time. And LucasArts said, we cannot put up the upfront capital to help you finish this game and get it printed. And by the way, the idea that the game was 100% complete, anytime someone attaches a percentage to a game development, you should be sort of skeptical. I suspect in this case, the game was probably around a beta level of release, meaning that the content was decided. They had built the levels. Essentially, you could play it from beginning to end, but it didn't mean they were finished with development. They probably had to go in and polish up a lot of things, get the frame rate up, do all the QA, all the localization. Ton of work needed.
It's not like it had gone gold and they were just sitting there literally waiting to print the packages.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Now, I will say that let's say the eShop was around back then, or it was, but I mean, like, they only allowed, 40 megabyte downloads WiiWare. If digital distribution was around back then, I could see it coming out. I don't see it coming out now because you can't download Wii games on your Wii U. It's not possible. But I think that if they could cut out the fact to get it to stores and print it on discs and all that stuff, I think that we could have actually seen the game out.
Yeah. By the way, I think it probably is possible to download Wii games. It's just Nintendo hasn't done the work. Well,
you know what I mean. I'm not saying that it's an impossible feat to do it.
It's not available.
It's not available. If it ever becomes available, who knows?
Yeah. But I mean, we were talking about Rogue Leader just recently. That GameCube launch title is still incredibly fun to play. It looks fantastic still. It sounds amazing. The idea of playing that, not even in HD, this is a Wii game, right? So it wasn't even in HD, but they had spruced up the graphics and added some motion controls and some various controller options to it. Julian talks about on the podcast for Rebel Strike, which is the very flawed follow-up to Rogue Leader. It was Rogue Squadron 3. That game came out in, 2003, probably, 2004? All the horrible on-foot missions that were in that game, they'd completely replaced those and redesigned all those levels with totally new control schemes and totally redone all that stuff. They had put in a lot more multiplayer modes, and it was basically going to be like the Metroid Prime trilogy of those games, where they had actually gone in and done a lot of work to make them better and sharper and redo the controls and give you a lot more controller options on the Wii, and it was still going to support GameCube controllers and that stuff. Watch those trailers. If you have not yet, it is heartbreaking to think that that game could have come out, especially 2008 and 9 would have been prime time. I mean, just, you know, having been the host of this podcast back then, it would have been a godsend to have something like that to play the Wii. So it's a real tragedy, but it's certainly not for lack of desire on the part of the people making the game. And I'm sure LucasArts would have liked to have done it, and they just said, hey, our company's about to melt into the ether, and there's no way we can give you, you know, $500,000 or $5 million, whatever it was going to cost to finish that game and get it printed at the time. Mm-hmm. It's a true shame. And, you know, I would hope that now that Disney owns the LucasArts back catalog, you know, now that the story is out there and obviously people are talking about it, maybe this is the sort of thing that Nintendo can sort of dredge up out of the pit and bring on some people to do a little bit of work and finish it one day.
Well, it's not like it's against it. You know, it can't happen. Like, for example, what Grim Fandango is happening because Sony and Devil Fine are working with Disney because Disney acquired the rights through buying like LucasArts, right? So that was part of LucasArts.
It's a very special, like, one-off deal, right? It's not like this is a machine that you can just pop in old games and they come out in HD on the other side. I mean, it takes a lot of people, a lot of effort. It takes someone who... Yeah, and it takes a community showing their support for this game and saying, we would buy this if you put it out there. And I hope that I'm sure Julian knows exactly what he's doing when he goes and talks to these guys. He wants this game to come out. He wants people to be able to play this. And maybe this is the start of that happening.
It really comes down to who fronts the money, right? You know, like who's going to pay for this? I mean, Disney will do anything with anyone.
Disney's not going to pay for this.
If somebody's going to put their money on the line. Yeah.
I feel like if Nintendo can save Bayonetta 2, they can save a freaking Star Wars game.
Yeah.
Don't say Kickstarter. Please don't say Kickstarter.
Yeah. Let's hope not. Yeah. There's better ways to do it.
One that I was always curious about now, you know, at the time I really didn't care about it because I wasn't playing any of Blizzard's games, but StarCraft Ghost always was kind of one that just went off into the ether, and I'm curious now to see what they would have done with it.
Well, it wasn't a terrible game when they shopped it around. When they showed it to us back in the day, I remember seeing it, and there wasn't any time when we were coming out of that room going, wow, that was a terrible game. No, it was really cool. And so there must have been something going on about that game that must not have sat well with them to kill it.
Well, didn't it bounce devs a couple times, too?
It was canceled and then restarted. Yeah, I played two different versions of StarCraft Ghost made by two different developers.
Dear God.
The first one, I think, was made by Paradox, if I'm remembering that correctly. It was one of the P developers back in the day. And I don't think it was Paradigm, and I don't think it was...
I mean, if I was going to make that game, Paradox would have been a company I considered to have make it.
Yeah, I think it was Paradox. And that one was a little bit more rough. And it was supposed to be more of a stealthy type thing. And then the follow-up was made by, what was it, like Ape something? But they were the guys who made, there was a multi-platform GameCube, PS2, Xbox game that they made where you played as this robot that went around, and it was kind of like Ratchet and Clank. It was like a third-person shooter.
Swing
Robot on Wheels?
Yeah. Yes. No, it wasn't Sprocket. It was
Metal Arms.
Metal Arms. Thank
Metal
you.
Metal Arms glitch in the system. There it is.
Yep, yep, yep. So it was those guys, and they were working on the revived version of StarCraft Ghost. And I played those at subsequent E3s. I played two different versions, and the second time it felt better, I think, and it looked nice. But and I wonder if that's a game where maybe they made a really good demo, but they couldn't really come up with a design plan to fill out a whole game around it in a way that Blizzard was satisfied. So.
Yeah, Blizzard is notoriously hard on even their own game designs. I mean, they'll kill entire MMOs after developing them for like 5 or 6 years. So.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, and Ghost was in development for at least 5 years, I would say. So, I'm sure that was a very difficult decision for somebody to make. But, there's a game, Craig, I bet you remember this because I probably only know about it because of you. I think it was called Tyrannosaurus Tex.
Oh yeah, that was the first person shooter on the Game Boy Color. Yeah, I remember that.
Was that? Did you get a sense that that was pretty far along? Because I know it never came out.
I played it. It wasn't terrible. But yeah, it was just like they probably couldn't find a publisher. Because again, it was you know, Game Boy Color cartridges are expensive, and not. It wasn't a licensed game. It didn't have a familiar title. All it really had to go on was it's a first-person shooter on the Game Boy Color, and so like the screenshots look like ass. Because it's doing tricks that to get this 3D perspective. So what are you selling it on? And so like the people that, you know, that they're probably shopping it to, they're just like, yeah, okay, you got dinosaurs and you got really crappy looking screenshots. What else you got? And, and so, yeah, I mean, it was,
it's tough.
It was all right. I mean, there was other games on the Game Boy Color. No, if I got this email ahead of time further than a couple hours, I probably would have pulled up a lot of stuff. It's like, where did this game go? But I think my ultimate answer, and I can't, and maybe you know the title to it, it was like this RC racing game for the N64. It was shown at the same E3 as a Dinosaur Planet.
Really, an RC racing game?
Yeah,
it was a Micro Machines game.
No, well, it was in a perspective. The camera was going to be published by Nintendo, and I can't remember the name, but it was like I'm sure you can probably pull it up on some website. And I apologize to your audience; they're probably screaming the title right now, and I just can't hear them.
I don't know what you're talking about. I was at that E3 2000. I'm wondering if it might have been shown even earlier than that when I wasn't at E3.
Maybe.
And every Nintendo game at E3 2000.
Yeah, it looked like a Micro Machines game, but I mean the camera obviously was polygonal, and so the camera positions could be like off into the crowd kind of thing. So you're looking at the track as a viewer, not behind the car or anything like that. But that's kind of my ideal racing game for me. I love arcade racing games, and so like, you know, to kind of like, you know, Championship Sprint and all that stuff. So yeah, this was going to be published by Nintendo. And I cannot remember the name of the game, and I'm really sorry.
Crazy.
Yeah. Wow.
That one doesn't even ring a bell, but, you know, I don't know how far along it was, but, you know, some of the stuff Retro Studios was working on before Nintendo came in and cleaned house and kicked out Spangenberg and...
Was it called Mini Racers?
Yes.
Yep. Mini Racers. Now, that Mini does Racers. Sound familiar.
Yep.
That would have been something I'd read on IGN 64.
Yeah, it was pretty much a completed game, and I guess they got cold feet because again, it's a non-licensed game. There's no familiar brand to it.
Developed by Looking Glass.
Yeah.
Ball Studios. Yeah. Isn't that bizarre? Wow.
Wait, yeah, Looking Glass, the people who made Thief?
Yeah, let me see.
Is that the Thief studio from? And,
yep.
Yeah, it would
yes,
be.
Yes, sir. Jeez. Yes, it is.
Weird.
Thief the Dark Project, and they also made John Madden Football 93 on the Genesis. They made Destruction Derby 64.
Yeah. Okay.
Bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah.
System Shock that would be, and System Shock 2.
I've always wanted that game to come out like on the virtual console, like just because, you know, just to kind of just end it, you know, like just complete the story, you know, like get this game out there.
I mean, apparently there is a playable version of that game out there. People have video of it up.
It was complete enough for IGN to write a preview on it.
Yeah, that's it was 83, yeah.
Yep.
You know, I remember playing that baseball game for GameCube.
Oh,
Pin and Chase. That was Pin and Chase Baseball.
I
played that, and that game was, I think, very, very close to being finished. And then Nintendo just decided, nah, we're going to do this Mario Sluggers thing instead, I guess. I was going to say about Retro Studios, there was a game that I remember we got some footage from. I think this was a Planet GameCube exclusive back in the day, maybe. But we had this crazy, like, 15 minutes of footage from Raven Blade, which was a third-person, like, action RPG that they were making for GameCube. And it was definitely not finished, but it seemed to be one of the farthest along things that Retro Studios was making alongside Metroid Prime.
Now, was that in the same group as Project Hammer?
No. Project Hammer was years later.
Was it years later? I'm getting that mixed up.
Yeah, Hammer was a Wii game.
Raven Blade was – maybe I'm thinking of something else, but there was like a group of games including Raven Blade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was also –
there was another one that was canceled. I think.
Yeah, there was a buggy racers game, like a dune buggy kind of racing game that they and there was a football game that Retro Studios was making, and those were all canceled. Yep. So they could focus on Metroid Prime. Probably the right decision at the time, frankly. But Ravenblade did, it was enticing, you know, definitely. And it was a period in which Nintendo seemed to finally be making RPGs internally.
Car Combat Thunder Rally was the one you're thinking of, the vehicular combat game.
Car Combat.
It's Car Combat / Thunder Rally, depending on what title they were using that day.
Thunder Rally is a much better title for sure. And then, you know, another one that that Nintendo Voice Chat podcast has mentioned lately, they had Mike Micah on it. He was telling them about a Gauntlet game that he'd made for Nintendo DS.
Yeah.
I think had online play, and it had four-player wireless, and it had RPG elements. And, it sounded so really bizarre. Cool. Did you ever play that
one? Yeah, I did play that one. It was pretty cool. I played versions. They were working on multiple Gauntlet games, but that one was pretty cool. And in fact, I think they showed it off at like GDC, to the public. But it was like, it was top down. It was all sprites, obviously, because the DS wasn't really a really good 3D system, but it could do 3D. So they just did sprites, and it had this really weird, like, European feel to it, just something from the graphic design. So, like, you know, because the sprites are
Codemasters game.
Yes, kind of like something like that, you know, like just, or actually more like a Psygnosis, that kind of that brownish color that they use, you know, like,
Psygnosis.
The thing is, everybody knows exactly what you mean when you say that. Yeah. That's what I think is so funny about it.
So I don't know if it was done by, you know, like the, if the company that Mike Michael was working with, Backbone, I think is what it was, if he was outsourcing it out to a European studio or whatever, but just really had this really European feel to it. But it was really cool. It was like, it had tons of like enemies on screen and stuff like that. But I mean, I could see how this game could end up being boring, simply just because Gauntlet is a very boring game. The whole, idea behind Gauntlet itself was to see how far you get on a quarter. And it was always meant to like steal your money away from you. I can get through this part. Let me put another quarter in. It's like, but when you translate to a game where it's just endless, it's very dull.
It's a hard thing to translate to a home experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's an arcade game that really, it only makes sense in the arcade. I think with Gauntlet Legends, actually Midway did a pretty nice job of giving it enough persistence and making it more about the level designs, so that there was a kind of a progression. There were bosses, and I played the ever-loving shit out of Gauntlet Legends on N64. So I think at one time that was a thing. It turned it into kind of like a Diablo style thing, but it was really fun. And then, you know, there is a new Gauntlet on Steam that I've heard is okay, maybe. You know, I haven't tried it myself. It's made by the Magicka
guys. That was a weird E3 demo. That was my takeaway from it. It felt very... I don't know.
Oh, you played the new one?
Yeah. It, you walked away thinking like, was that good or was that not good? I don't know what just happened.
Yeah. So there's many examples over the years, but I do think it's probably important to tell people that, you know, just because a game is mostly finished, sometimes that last stretch is the most difficult part, you know, and it could be the most expensive part depending on the size of your team and, you know, the things that they did well up front versus the things that still really need to happen at the end before it's actually ready for prime time.
I have a much more recent example, and it's kind of a weird one. It was the prototype, they called it Prototype Edition Mega Man Legends 3 demo that apparently only one journalist ever played. Huh. And it's like a nearly complete version of that demo that was played by, I can't remember who it was, but it was at a Nintendo Power.
And that was the demo that Capcom was going to sell in order to raise capital / gauge interest in
a
full version.
Oh my God, Capcom. that whole saga was the Capcom-iest thing ever. But they I don't remember who it was, but one of the Nintendo Power writers actually went to Capcom and played the either complete or very, very, very nearly complete demo like weeks before it was going to come out, and they just canceled, which is baffling and confusing, but we will probably never have that one leak because they probably have all the copies in house, so we'll never know what that game actually played like.
I wonder if that's the kind of thing that might show up on a weird compilation disc, you know, one day in the future when, you know, someone at Capcom decides they care about Mega Man again. Maybe Smash Brothers convinces them that people still like that character.
Well, I mean, they're busy putting Mega Man cat armor into games, so they're fine. They're good. Yeah. He's well represented. It's fine.
He's now in Monster Hunter 4 for some reason. Anyway, we should move on. But that Rogue Leader thing is a really painful, idea that that could have come out for the Wii in 2008 and would have – and Julian was bragging about this, but I think he's exactly right. It probably would have been the best-looking Wii game ever released.
100%.
Yeah. I totally believe him. And the video does look really nice for sure. So that one's painful, but maybe it's not completely dead. I mean, we mentioned it not too long ago, but, you know, with the new Star Wars movies coming out, there will be new Star Wars video games, and there will be a demand for that stuff. And I wonder if Disney will be smart enough to go back and say, hey, somebody put a lot of work into this. It might
Or let's work with Nintendo on getting those, you know, GameCube and N64 games on the Virtual Console.
Nintendo should be desperate to get Star Wars back on their systems.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Star Wars used to be associated with Nintendo for a long time, really. And the best Star Wars games were always on Nintendo systems. And then, nothing.
I will say, to specifically of Star Wars games going forward, Disney, once they got the license... from the video game standpoint, has still been very conservative with using it. Only a handful of games so far, I think, have been greenlit. I don't know if any of them have come out.
They haven't had it for very long.
No, and, but I mean, they it sounds like they stopped everything and said, all right, let's reevaluate what we want to do with this license.
Well, there's the one in development right now.
There's the one.
Battlefield, right?
Yeah.
Or Battlefront, sorry.
Battlefront, yeah.
Yep.
All right, so let's move on to the next email, and this one is from PB, who's actually Perry Burkham, the guy who wrote our new theme song. And PB writes, what game that's a sequel do you think is the most different from its predecessor? Not
this
a spiritual
like
successor,
last
but an official sequel. And on the contrary, what game do you think is the most similar to its prequel? That one...
Madden.
That one
of them.
Yeah.
Many of them.
Well played, James.
That one might be a little too easy, but in terms of a sequel that is completely different than the previous game, like a numbered sequel, you know.
What about Street Fighter 2010? Is that considered a sequel?
That's like a weird
all the weird Street Fighter sequels.
It's a Street Fighter game, and it's a numbered sequel.
Human killing machine, Street Fighter. Yeah, they're pretty different.
I always have to go back to Zelda too. It is such a bold, completely bizarre intro. I mean, really like a fascinating game, and it is so remarkably different than the first one. And was like a one-off experiment that they've never gone back to. And I really think they should. I would love to see a new Zelda game made in the style of Zelda 2, because I think it's very fertile ground.
Wasn't one of the Philips CDI games kind of that, though?
It was
not
kind
even
of
made
like,
by Nintendo,
yes.
though, so, it, you know.
It is structured similarly, but that is the only thing that you would compare them on.
Yeah, and let's not speak of that
the list. Let's say the better, right?
Yeah,
for me, it'd be Castlevania II Simon's Quest falls into the same boat as Zelda 2. It's very, very different from the first Castlevania.
But
if you look at a screenshot of Castlevania 2, though, it doesn't necessarily look that different than the first one. It just...
Yeah.
The game is structured so differently.
Yep.
A lot of those NES games, they're still experimenting with form. You end up with these weird... Or you get something like it was like an MSX game that they ported to the NES badly.
Right.
Or the Famicom. And then the Famicom became the lead platform for the sequel, so they built a game based around its capacity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, I got one. Even though the game didn't come out, the sequel was going to be so drastic. Marble Madness 2. Where, I don't know if you know the sequel to Marble Madness.
No.
Have you ever heard of it? It's called Marble Man.
Oh my God.
Have you not heard of this?
No,
okay,
I've not heard of
this. Yeah. So basically, Atari, obviously, you know, after, man, I can't think of his name now.
From Sony now. Yeah.
Yes. I can't think of his name.
Mark Cerny.
Excellent. Thank you. God. But he wouldn't moved on. But they wanted to do a sequel. I don't think he had anything to do with this game. But it was the same perspective, the same weird grid style and everything. But they threw out the trackball in favor of a joystick to be just cheaper. And you could transform your marble into a guy and walk around the level. And it's the most bizarre thing ever. I actually played the prototype. It shows up every year at California Extreme, which is it's like this arcade gathering every year in the Bay Area. And since there's a lot of prototypes that show up, you know, because this was where the arcade business was built. So like a lot of people still have the prototypes, and yeah, someone had a prototype of Marble Man, and it's probably the, like, Marble Madness 2, Marble Man, and it's like, that's probably the most drastic change of anything.
Yeah. I can't see how being a human and transforming into a ball and rolling around would be fun.
Yeah.
Just can't see how that would be fun.
No, no, it's the other way around, John. You're a ball who transforms,
yeah, transforms into
a human.
Into the guy that walks around and has legs.
True.
Yeah.
Well, see, there you go. That makes it fun.
I think you guys missed John's beautiful little Metroid joke there.
No, we didn't.
You know, this might surprise you guys, because it's probably not one that you would think of for an answer to this. But I'm going to go with Mario 64, Super Mario 64. It's a numbered, it has a number in the title, but it's also obviously a direct sequel to the Super Mario Brothers games. And it is that people, if you take yourself out of the moment a little bit of playing that game for the first time, it is so radically, bizarrely different than any Mario game that came before it. And it's not just that they've made it into 3D. That game plays completely differently. Mario punches and he kicks.
Well,
and
the structure different. Yeah, like the goal is completely different.
Right.
Like, I mean, you're going into these levels and there is no flagpole. You're going after a star, and the star could be hidden. It could be way up in the clouds. It could be something
on top
that
of a flagpole.
You talk to characters, and sometimes they just say, "Hey, let's have a race, or let's do a mission together."
Yeah.
Or, "Can you please go kill that enemy?" That game plays absolutely nothing like any other Mario game. It's amazing that we just took it for granted and said, "Oh, cool, it's the new Mario, and it's in 3D. That's awesome."
Yeah,
I don't even think that
game gets the credit that it does for being so groundbreaking, because literally there was no game like that out when that game was released.
I wouldn't say we took it for granted, right? I mean, like, this was when it came out, it was like just the dawn of the internet, and the community hasn't been as jaded as it is now, right? So, just imagine if that game came out with the internet being as, you know, with the community being out there and just being gruff and grumble as they are now. Like, basically, if that game came out as it is, you know, after, you know, years and years of 2D side scrolling games, do you think that it would have been welcome with open arms?
I mean,
to the community?
Well, I think a lot of the reason that people just took that stuff, you know, without really questioning it is because all the weird things that 64 did to the Mario franchise and the way that it twisted the concepts and introduced completely new concepts was all overshadowed by the fact that it's a 3D game that actually plays well. And the fact that they figured out solutions to so many problems that had plagued 3D games up to that point, and they made one that was actually fun to play, because really most of them before that were not very much fun at all.
Yeah.
That became the story, the narrative around that game. And of course, it's a magnificent game. It's one of my favorite games ever. But I think all of those things overshadow the fact that it is a drastic reimagining of who Mario is as a character and what his games are about and the things that you would do in a Mario game. It is just astonishingly different than anything that came before it. And it really set a tone. And if you play stuff like Mario Galaxy now, Mario Galaxy 2 even, it's really not that different. You know, even New Super Mario World Super Mario 3D World really doesn't play that differently than 64. I mean, it still uses a lot of the same principles. So the fact that they got away with so much in 64, and a lot of it is, I think, because, there was the sideshow of, oh my God, look at these graphics, feel the camera, feel the analog joystick that's built into the controller. I mean, that's a launch game. And it was so refreshing at the time
it's amazing they got so much right, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like this, they pretty much made this genre.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, they there was nothing to compare that game to at the time. And they knocked it out of the park.
Well, it's a genre that doesn't exist anymore, because the people have abandoned that the 3D platforming genre, except for Nintendo. No one else does it. So,
yeah, very few.
Well, even Nintendo doesn't do it a lot anymore.
Yeah.
But,
right.
But then, you know, it's followed up, and sometimes people compare like Metroid Prime to Mario 64 in terms of it also brought a classic 2D franchise into 3D. But if you think about it, playing Metroid Prime feels very much like a direct translation of a game like Super Metroid into 3D. I mean, they made some changes as necessary, but the structure of that game, the way that you progress from one task to another, the overall things that you're doing in Metroid Prime are in a lot of ways very faithful to what that series did in 2D, and Mario 64, not at all. That game is just drastically different than the games that came before it. And I don't know that it gets quite enough credit for, you know, just dumping the bucket and saying, let's just start over. You know, there's almost nothing in Mario 64. I mean, think about the fact that there are maybe 5 Koopa Troopas in that entire game. It's amazing. And what happens when you jump on them? You start surfing. You know, yeah. I mean, it bears no resemblance whatsoever to any previous Mario game. It's amazing that they got away with it being so radically different. And I love it for that. I wish they would do that again, actually. why don't we move on to the final question, which John is going to read for us.
All right. Delaney from Las Vegas writes, when is the best time to buy a console? Should you be a day one buyer to be in the thick of the action and excitement, or maybe a midlife buyer when the library is more fleshed out but not in its prime yet and exciting things are still coming out? Or like I did with my 360 and buy it at the end of its life cycle when most of the best games have come out and they are all cheap and easy to obtain?
How crazy are you?
Yeah, I mean, like, it all depends on, like, you know, do you want to play video games? Then you buy a console when you're ready to play video games. Like, I buy consoles when they come out. I don't regret the fact that they're more expensive. I don't regret that there's not enough games for them. But I buy that console so I have the ability to play the game when they come out, right? If you don't have the console, you don't have that opportunity to buy that game. And I just want to be able to play a game, so I have the console the first day it's out. Simply because, A, I'm a gadget file. I just love having gadgets, like, the fresh and new. But also because I now have the opportunity to purchase games that, if you don't have the console, you don't have the opportunity to purchase them.
So for you, is the quality of, let's say, the early software kind of irrelevant? Like, you say, well, I assume that the games will be good enough for now, or I assume that they'll get better and I'll want to have the system anyway, so I'm going to go ahead and buy it.
Yeah. I know that there are going to be games coming out, regardless if it's going to be tomorrow, a week, a month now. At least I have the ability to get them when they come out. I don't care that I spent an extra $100 on it because, you know, in 2 years, I'm not even going to care that I spent an extra $100 on my console. It doesn't matter. That money, you know, if you actually factor it out, it's pennies every day I had that console. So I don't really care. Mm-hmm. I just want to actually have the opportunity to play the games when they come out. And if you don't own the console, then you can't even make that decision. You're like, I guess I can wait when it goes cheaper. And, you know, I'll get the console later, you know, so, I mean, like, I know, understand his question, but to me, that my answer is just on day one, that's when I buy the console.
Yeah. I think this question is very different for someone who only buys Nintendo systems and only plays Nintendo games, because, you know, with a lot of other cases, you might say, well, if you don't buy the system at launch, you can focus a little more on the previous system, which is probably still getting games that are probably more affordable and more mature and more fun to play, frankly. And you'll get more out of playing the older systems. I mean, you know, a lot of people have been saying the past year or so since the PS4 came out, well, I've been playing my PS3 more than my PS4 because there were so many great PS3 games that came out in the past 18 months or so. And that's true. They have been. I think PS4 is catching up and is a lot more viable now than it was 6 months ago even. But, you know, for a Nintendo fan, Nintendo does not do a good job of supporting their systems in the back, you know, couple of years even.
Yeah, not
before
anymore,
the next
now.
System comes out. They not for a very long time.
Say, John, do you remember the N64? Do you remember that?
I mean, even Super Nintendo really didn't have a lot of good games.
One game a month.
95, yeah. 96.
Well, it was like that start to finish.
So I think it's been a very, very, very long time since Nintendo has done a good job of supporting the previous generation, even up to the launch, much less beyond it. And so I think if you're really only interested in buying Nintendo systems, you really need to buy them at launch. But on the flip side, Nintendo typically has pretty good launch titles. You know, they do a lot better than third parties do, for instance.
But see, I think
I wouldn't say that. Yeah, go ahead.
I think you could make the same argument in the opposite direction, though, which is there's always going to be a supply of Nintendo published games out there, so you could wait a year in and get it, and then get those games.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, a lot of people are like, should I buy a Wii U right now? And I'll be like, no, when it first came out, because there's only like 2 games for it. But like, I now say, yes, you can buy a Wii U now because there are a ton of really awesome games. Mm-hmm. But for me, personally, I want to have the system so that I can play the games as they come out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of did all three strategies in the last generation. I bought a Wii on launch day. I bought a 360 right before it became apparent that 360 was going to start just completely steamrolling that generation in terms of what were the games like being the lead platform. And then I bought a PS3 about a year before the PS4 came out. And I got to have all those experiences where when, like in the early where you buy a game and then you wait and you don't touch it, the system for a while because you played the games.
Yeah.
I had the 360 where I had that immediate catch up window of like, oh my God, I've got all these games I can play. And then, you know, then I was basically back on the release schedule with everybody else. And then I had the PS3 where I will never catch up on that system. I just
know, but also you bought it at the mass market price where all the, you know, the games right. are so cheap and they're so abundant.
I paid
such
like
a massive backlog.
It's just
at that
it's
point
like Netflix
that,
for you.
Yeah.
You just
yeah,
jump
like I
in
paid
and
nine
say,
bucks for Ni No Kuni. It's like whatever, yeah. you know,
give me all the games.
Yeah.
To be honest, if someone was just wanting a bunch of really cheap games, right? You know, it's like should they buy a console like the 360 to get the games cheap? At that point, just buy a PC because, like, you know, Steam
sure.
has sales
yeah.
so often that you're barely going to spend anything at all if you just want a bunch of games that you just want to play, regardless
Absolutely.
Of if it's top of the line, you know, front line or whatever. You know, get a PC instead of going to the console.
Yeah, if you want like some kind of gaming video game cultural literacy, it's like there's all these games that are famous and that people talk about and they say, you know, everyone should play this game. Everyone should experience this story. It's hard to argue against PC because yes, you'll pay more upfront for the hardware than you will for a console, but then the games are cheap probably forever, you know,
yeah.
and the back catalog is just ridiculous. And that hasn't always been the case, but PC has matured so much as a gaming platform in the past 5 years that anything released within the past 5 years is probably going to have a really good PC version. I mean,
yeah, well, it helps that the, you know, the consoles are now in parity with PC. Like the Xbox One and the PS4 are all PC architecture. So it's very easy for a developer to go, hey, I'm going to make a console version, but I'm also going to make the PC version because it's simple to do. I mean, look at the FIFA 14 that just came out on PC. That exists because it was easy for them to port the Xbox One PS4 over to the PC. Otherwise, it would have never happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, with Wii U, of course, Nintendo stuff will never be on PC, so that's a whole different calculus. But I have to give Nintendo a lot of credit because, obviously, it was pretty clear from the beginning, from launch day, that Wii U was not going to be a huge hit and that it had a lot of problems, you know, bad timing, bad market conditions. Hardware was confusing, the marketing was atrocious, and the early games were good. I mean, I think, you know, New Super Mario Bros. U is one of the best launch titles ever, just in terms of quality. The polish on that game is astounding. It's so much fun to play. But it's not really what people wanted to play at that time. And I give Nintendo a ton of credit for really sticking with it, and they, you know, look, Wii U will never be the success that even N64 was. But we can make this a viable thing. We can please our fans. We can make it work until whatever the next thing is. And they've done that. And because of the steady release, not frequent, but steady release of games that they've had for it, and the very high quality on average of the games that they've put out there, they have really, I think, convinced a lot of people that the system really is building up the kind of back catalog that starts to become convincing, especially as the hardware price comes down. I think the system is still a little bit too expensive for like the mass market people to say, oh yeah, there's a couple of Mario games and a Zelda game and a Mario Kart game that I really want to play. I should pick up one of those. But I think they're on the right track to getting there either by this holiday, probably not this holiday season, but next, you know, and if they can continue at least to get through next holiday season with the regular releases of games every 2 or 3 months that actually people like and talk about and they want to keep playing, I think they'll be okay. I mean, I think it'll be good enough to get them through it. But yeah, for Wii U, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, I didn't feel duped by buying the Wii U at launch. I feel like I kind of knew what I was getting into.
Yeah, we knew what we were getting into.
But it's not – I mean, you know, even – 12 months after the Wii U came out, I had people coming over to my house who had no idea what it was. They'd never seen one. They'd never played one. They were afraid to pick up the gamepad because they're like, I don't even know how to approach a controller that looks like that.
Yeah.
But I think nowadays it's pretty easy for me to say, hey, you know, I mean, there's certain genres and things like that that you're not going to get on the Wii U, but there are definitely enough games. There's the critical mass for the average person is there, especially if you're a video game fan. I mean, if you play other things on other systems, there's plenty to like on the Wii U. It's a fairly easy decision. And, you know, maybe that means, hey, go to the Nintendo web store and buy a refurbished unit for $200 or $150. But still, the games are there. They really are.
Yeah, I mean, I held off this gen on all three consoles. I own all of them now. I got a PS4, Xbox One, and Wii U, obviously. But I didn't really, you know, I did the same thing with 3DS as well. And it was interesting. I found, because usually I used to be a day one guy. I would just buy it really for the same kind of, you know, rationale that Craig outlined. Like, I just wanted to have it just in case there was something that I wanted right away and didn't want to miss anything, right? And I realized that I don't really miss anything because, you know, you kind of get to see how the console performs, sort of what's the market factors at play, you know, what people think about, what kind of bugs are in it, sort of thing. It's almost like when an Apple product comes out. You never really, you know, you can buy that first one if you really want, like the iPhone 6, but, you know, you hear something, something's wrong with it, or the Wi-Fi doesn't work properly or something like that. So you kind of let them work the kinks out. And it's kind of like that with Xbox One. It's been like that.
I mean, the angriest tweet, John.
On iPhone, I'm an S model guy. I want the one that they fixed.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's a lot of stuff that, I mean, you know, both on Xbox One and PS4 and Wii U as well, there's a lot of features right out of the gate that aren't there. And like, I went through this a long time ago when I got my Wii U. They didn't allow you to output audio the way that I wanted to output it. And fortunately, the very day that I decided to hook it up, out of nowhere, they released an update to enable the audio setting that I wanted. And so there's stuff like that that you don't really think about, but with these consoles, the way you can update them now, you're not really going to miss much. And in fact, probably even if you wait 6 months or even a year after the console launch, you'll probably get a better console than what the people at launch actually picked up.
It's true.
So you're not losing anything, really.
Yeah, and with 3DS even, I mean, the way Nintendo iterates on their handhelds, it's pretty easy to make the argument. It's similar like with the iPhones. It's maybe worth getting every other version of the hardware that comes out or something, because, you know, the changes from one to the next are nice, but they're not necessarily necessary. They're not game breakers, you know, they're not huge deals. But if you wait every couple of generations, then you'll have a pretty major leap. And it's like, you know, you guys have been talking about trading in your launch day units for the new 3DS once that comes out here. You're going to be very happy with that upgrade, I think. Mm-hmm. Whereas it might be more subtle for someone like me who has an XL and uses it quite a bit, and I'm accustomed to the improvements that they made in that version. For you guys, it's going to be night and day, and I think you're going to be really happy with that purchase. So it really depends on your situation, and it depends on your priorities, right? It depends on how you value your money, because you definitely pay a premium for being an early adopter. And that's not to say it's always a bad decision. It just depends on what do you expect from that system? What do you get out of it? What is the reason that you're buying the system in the first place? Is it gadget fever? Or is it you just don't, if you don't really care about the platform, you just want the games, then you're probably better off waiting, because the games often are not there early on and they show up later.
Yeah, like I wound up jumping in when there was kind of a critical mass of games that I wanted, like for 3DS, Mario Kart, and, you know, like Super Mario 3D Land, and it was pretty good. You know, I, like, right out of the gate, I had three great games to go along with my 3DS, whereas if I would have bought it at launch, I wouldn't have had that.
You wouldn't have had any of those, probably.
Yeah. Yep. I wouldn't have had any.
Not the ones that you wanted, anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So, good question. We're going to wrap it up now. But again, the email address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Thank you very much, everyone who writes. Even if we don't get to read your question on the show, we do appreciate it. We read everything. We try to respond to people as well when we get a chance. But that is going to wrap up our show. And before we go, I want to mention that the Famicast, our friends in Japan who have their own, I believe it is the only Nintendo podcast recorded in Japan, in English. And that show is getting its own podcast feed. I think there will be one last episode. It might even come out before you hear this one, episode 42. But then the one after that is going to be on their own feed. So if you enjoy the Famicast, we would highly encourage you to be on the lookout for that. And I believe they're going to record some kind of message helping people make the transition over there. But they're going bi-weekly. They got new art. They've got some new format things in mind. So we're really excited for those guys. They're sort of becoming – they're going independent. They're becoming their own thing. They're growing up and leaving the nest. And I'm really excited to see what happens with that show. So be on the lookout for it very soon. For that, and you know, it'll be a new subscription for you, but it'll be a little bit easier to organize those episodes, and they'll be able to release their stuff sooner and more frequently without having to coordinate with us every single time that they do. So it'll be a good thing for everybody. So yeah, please be on the lookout for that. We'll make sure you don't get left behind. Don't worry. Also, something I'm really excited about, and I teased it last week, but there is now the RFN Powered Off magazine is now available.
It is a very
silly thing that we put together with tons of help from Nicholas Bray, who's a fan of the show, has been on it a couple of times, and is in charge of the Powered Off PDF magazine, and he offered to do an issue about RFN. We wrote most of the content. And then he did the layout. Andrew Brown did the cover. Very, very fun cover. Very colorful layout for the issue.
Sure. So,
yeah, featuring some pretty bad photos of us, the four of us.
There's a screenshot that John and I saw had it going around today with the site column ads and stuff. It's ghastly.
Yeah. We've been having a lot of fun with promoting this on Twitter, and the people who've been reading it have really enjoyed it. I read through the whole thing last night, and I got a big kick out of it. So if you're a fan of this podcast, and I know that you are, I hope you go check that out. It is a PDF download. You can read it anywhere you want, whether you're on the internet or not. You can print it out. I think I'm going to print out some copies for my family for Christmas.
Sure, Johnny. Do whatever you want.
Do whatever you want, Johnny.
Why not?
You know, talk about the Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah. No, but it's cool. We have our own magazine. I mean, it's a one-time deal, but it's still really cool. And I appreciate the guys who helped make that possible, and I hope people will go check it out. It's all original content, all of it, original content that we wrote about doing the podcast. So I hope you go check that out. It is kind of one of the final pieces of the puzzle for 400. And we really do appreciate the work that everybody put into it. And one last thing. Thank you, Craig Harris, for being our special guest this week.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely, man. It's always a pleasure to have you. And this is actually, you had some good topics for you to talk about this week.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to plug or your Twitter handle or something like that?
Hire me. I'm on the market. Honestly, no, I got nothing. I'm just going to enjoy my fun vacation or fun employment is what I call it. unemployment, fun employment. No, I got nothing to plug.
All right, man. Well, best wishes to you. I really hope you get something awesome very soon because you deserve it. You're a great guy. And we really appreciate you being on here, buddy.
All right.
So,
thanks a lot, man.
Everybody, thank Craig for being on the show.
Thank you,
I
Craig.
I love having him on here.
You're welcome.
And, oh yeah, one last thing I should mention. Our telethon is coming back in a couple of weeks. So the article is up on the website. You can go read about all the plans for it. And I believe the donations are now live. So if you want to go ahead and get your donation in now so you don't forget about it later, you can go ahead and do that. And we'll have Carl on hopefully before that weekend to tell you a little bit more about it. But it's our fifth year. I think most people listening are pretty familiar with how that goes. It's all for the Child's Play charity. It's a great cause. And we will be spending the better part of a Saturday talking about video games live on the internet. It's a very stupid thing that we do, and it's really fun.
It's going to be way more dumb. John and I have an unchaperoned hour.
Yes.
Yeah. Something about unlicensed games. I'm terrified.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a lot to soak in about the planning for that, and I've still got a lot of work to do on it myself, but I'm really excited about it. We hope you will join us. That is in early November. I think it's the first weekend of November. Go to the website and check it out. There'll be a link in the show article, of course. So that's it. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Later.